Moncrief on News Talk.
Time for Moncrief's Murder Club. Today, Cassie Delaney will be guiding us through some strange criminal cases. And we're talking today about cases where people disappeared, but then came back. Well, mostly they came back. Afternoon, Cassie.
Afternoon, Sean. Well, some of them came back. One of them is just a great story involving
and the first
big
one
celeb.
People will remember a bit.
Yes, yeah. This is one of my favourite stories. I always say, can you believe it with this one? We have a man called John Darwin, who is a teacher turned prison guard.
Yeah.
Very strange kind of career choices. And on the 21st of March 2002, he's at the seaside spot on the north coast of England near Hartlepool, and he goes out on his little red kayak. Nothing unusual. He's 51 years of age. This is something that he does regularly. He's a well-known canoer, well-known kind of sea adventurer, except this time he doesn't come back. He fails to turn up for his shift at the prison and he's reported missing. Coast Guard launches a major search, more than 60 square miles of coastline combed by boat and air. The wreckage of his kayak turns up the next day, along with a double-ended paddle. So one thing that was kind of bothersome to the research or the rescuers at this point was that the sea had kind of been calm, that there's no reason why an experienced kayaker would have gotten into such difficulty, especially someone like John, who was known to do it regularly. He was very, very experienced, and no body is ever found. So the obvious explanation here is that the sea just took him. It happens sometimes when bodies are lost at sea. It's very hard to recover them. His wife, Anne, is a grieving widow and plays the part exceptionally well. She plays it for years. An inquest eventually returns the verdict that John Darwin is formally declared dead, which is the entire point, I suppose, of whatever Con was
And there are two sons here involved.
There are two grown-up sons who grieve their father and really are in a great deal of pain and grief over this. Anne collects on his life insurance money after a couple of years, pension policies, into the region of about £250,000. She uses it to clear off the mortgage on the family home. And as far as the world is concerned, this is just a tragic accident that has impacted this poor little family. But what the world didn't know and realise is that not only did John Darwin survive, he actually just climbed out of the kayak that day and went back into his own family home. He went back in the side door into a little kind of bed set that they had next door. And he spent great stretches of these years that he was supposedly dead just hiding out there.
And what's weird is that nobody noticed on the street they lived in, did they?
Bit of a recluse. I guess he wasn't going in and out.
Yeah.
But like the sons, who presumably were in the house with the mother, not realising the father was next door. The amount of mourners who must have come through to grieve him. I don't know if the British do the kind of wakes like we do, but I'd imagine there was a bit of a re-raw in the house around the funeral time or when he was declared dead. And nobody realised that the entire time he was just next door. But being dead is terribly restrictive, you know.
There's not
a lot you can get up to.
Yeah.
And John kind of gets bored of it after all. Because bear in mind, he's only 51 when this happens. He's still got a lot of life in him, especially given the fact that he's not dead at all. So he decides to start travelling. He obtains a passport of a dead baby infant and starts to set up.
That is also, I would have thought, I know that in movies that happens, but I would have thought in real life you could actually get away with that.
I would have assumed that when you scanned the passport, it might have come up saying that this person is
dead.
Deceased. Yeah. But he decides to do this anyway, and he goes off and he starts building a life for himself in Panama. Anne sells the family home and tells her sons that she's emigrating. And this comes apropos of nothing to them, you know. And she's building a new life in Central America. But she's actually there, of course, with John. Now, what happens, they've kind of gotten away with it. And everything could have been all well and good in Panama, but things mustn't have been living up to expectations. Because in 2007, more than 5 years after he'd supposedly drowned, John walks into a police station in London and says he thinks he's a missing person.
So now, the odd thing about that is that he'd already gone, I assume, to Panama and she'd followed him. But something must have happened in Panama where he came back.
Because she doesn't come back.
So
he comes back to London. I don't know, maybe there was an event or a match or something that he wanted to attend.
Or they had a row with some sort.
Yeah, something like that. So he says he can't remember anything since 2000 and is again, seeking sympathy, assuming, like we've had before, that if you have amnesia, all is forgiven.
Yeah.
Forgiven because you can't remember anything before.
That's been in movies as well. Yeah. I can see where he's getting his inspiration.
The thing with John is he hasn't actually done a lot of research here. So when he comes in, the investigators ask him what 9/11 means to him. He says 20. Asked about 7/7, he says 14. And he probably thinks he's being very clever, but they quickly recognize that that is not how amnesia works. This is not, these are not symptoms that match any recognized pattern of memory loss. So he is, for all intents and purposes, and in the clinical sense, absolutely faking it. And he gets called on it pretty quickly. But the second problem, and this is the one I just think is such a funny detail, is a photograph. Because when John and Anne decided to go off to Panama, they didn't do it on their own. They didn't do their old research. They did the kind of budget holiday and found an agency that helped people set up new lives in Panama. And not only did they do that and have a paper trace, they posed for a photograph in a review of the website.
Oh.
So they were featured on the website.
In their own names.
In their own names, as the Panamanian property advisor talks to them about buying an apartment. And they're delighted. This is, again, it takes place at all the times he's supposed to be dead and missing and have amnesia for that matter as well. So it's just two people who thought nobody would really dig deep and check on them, thinking they could maybe get away with this £250,000 in life insurance. So the photo is published across national papers and everything collapses. Anne, who had been telling journalists that there was reasons why she couldn't go back home to the UK, has said that, because apparently the news got back to her, that he's found alive. And instead of rushing back to his side, she's sitting over there in her sun lounger, drinking water out of a coconut and whatever else. And she's trying to make up all these excuses as to why she's not coming back. But obviously she's evading capture because she knows him. As soon as she lands, she's going to get arrested. And she does. John is in custody. And 2008, the pair are convicted. He pleads guilty. She fights it, but is found guilty of fraud and money laundering. He gets 6 years and 3 months. She gets 6.5 because she denied it initially.
Oh, I know. Yeah, but he pleaded guilty and he nearly got the same as her.
Yeah, so, I mean, she wasted jurors' time. I suppose there wouldn't have been a trial for him, really. But I mean, in all of this, it's impossible not to think about the sons that the whole time believed that their father had died and their mother had essentially abandoned them for a new life in Panama, and nobody ever really consulted with them. They did divorce in prison, and kind of a lasting legacy is that the town's local hotel had named a bar after John Darwin.
Yes. Did anyone ever hear from the sons?
I think they want to stay out. I mean, to stay away from it. It's kind of a lot of negative attention. I mean, I know everybody has issues in their families, but your parents doing that and not telling you. I don't know what's worse, your parents doing it or your parents not bringing you in on the con.
Yeah. But maybe they couldn't trust them. Maybe they.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
That's just, yeah, that says a lot, doesn't it?
They brought up their kids properly, not to be completely dishonest, and then they proved to be a disappointment.
Yeah,
to their
like
parents.
Your mom and dad think you'll be a snitch. They can't get into the family con while they go spend all your dad's life insurance money.
Yes, but that they got divorced though.
They did get divorced in
something.
Prison.
Yeah,
I'd say there was some sort of row. I mean, it's a lot of time to spend together, stuck in one property, if one person is pretending to be dead and doesn't have other hobbies. You know.
Yeah, and they've given up their entire lives.
Yeah.
And maybe he started to see. And he'd been pretending to be dead longer than she had, so...
Yeah.
It probably...
And I'd say maybe he kind of pressured her into Panama as well. She seemed happy out there in the UK, just living this little life, spending all her money. No mortgage.
Yeah.
Panama
would
have been a leap, you know?
Yeah. And probably the poor sons are saying, where's all the money gone?
That's it. I'm assuming they had to give a lot of it back.
Yeah. Right, so the second story, this is in California. This is quite a dark story and it also leaves a lot of questions and answers.
Yeah, this one is really strange. It kind of starts off as essentially a classic missing persons case. We have five friends. We're in 1978 in February, so the weather's kind of bad. Five friends set off to go watch a basketball game. Their names are Jack Madruga, Bill Sterling, Jackie Hewitt, Ted Weir and Gary Matthews. They're all grown men aged between 24 and 32. Everyone who knows them calls them the boys. They're a little gang. They do have mild intellectual disabilities or psychiatric disabilities, but they know each other from playing basketball together in the same team. And they kind of have these fixed routines, very able, very out there, very social, but they do not deviate from their kind of structure and their routines. So they take off to go to this match. and they go to the game, but afterwards they stop at a store, buy some snacks, chocolate milk, and head off in the direction of home. But they never arrive. So they don't come home. Their families immediately send out panic alerts because this is so strange for them. So I think much quicker than this happened to anybody else, there is high alert. And after 3 days of a big search, they find the car that they were traveling in, but it wasn't on the route home. It's nearly 50 miles in the wrong direction. Again, a detail that's very, very strange for this particular group of people. It is on the road in Plumas National Forest. So it's deep in kind of where there would have been snow in Nevada, but not so much snow that they couldn't have gotten out of it and driven home.
Yeah.
Everything about this scene and finding the car is strange. So as I said, it's stuck in relatively shallow snow. They could have easily pushed it out. There's a quarter of a tank of petrol. Their doors are unlocked. The window is rolled down. There's maps there. There's snacks that had been eaten and the keys are gone. So it's like they kind of didn't really try to get it out of any difficulty. There was no signs that they had tried to push it. But it's like they had escaped the vehicle and walked into the mountains away from the road. Again, a very, very strange thing. And as five people who didn't like to deviate from what was standard, this just seems like very strange details. So then there's a brutal snowstorm and it basically shuts down any search and they can't discover anything in the mountains. But there is one witness, a man named Joseph, who comes forward and says that on the same night, he had driven up the same remote road to check on a cabin ahead of a family ski trip that he was going on. His car did get stuck in the snow and while trying to free it, he had a heart attack. A difficult time for very, very, very difficult time for that guy. But he retreated into his vehicle and turned on the heater. He was in pain. He waited for help. And then later that night, he saw headlights pull up behind him. So it could have been these guys. He saw figures, several men, he said. But interestingly, he thought there was a woman holding a baby. Now, there wouldn't have been with these guys. And they were standing in the glow of the lights. He called them for help, but then the lights went out and the voices went silent. So he called out again for help, but they disappeared into the dark. And he says he saw flashlight beams again a couple of hours later. He called and nothing happened. Eventually, he made it down the mountain himself. Now, because of the heart attack and because he was in immense pain, his testimony is kind of questioned. Was he a reliable witness, or was he someone who might have been seeing things in an intense medical emergency? So we get to kind of that happens in February and it's June before they can revisit the search because there had been so much snow. And it's in June that a group of motorcyclists are in the forest and they come across a US Forest Service trailer about 20 miles from where the car had been abandoned. And inside on a bed wrapped in sheets is the body of Ted. He's died of starvation and exposure. But this part, this detail is so, so strange. The trailer contained food, matches and fuel and heating materials. Mm. So there was no reason why exposure would have been a major issue. They just weren't used. There was enough food, enough rations to survive on. And he had grown a beard, which indicates that he had survived there for quite some time. And instead, but he'd slowly starved to death, surrounded by food that he didn't eat. And he had, you know, succumbed to exposure, surrounded by fuel that he didn't use. His shoes were missing and then found in the trailer were the shoes belonging to Gary, suggesting that Gary had put on Ted's shoes, that he had also survived there for a while, but at some point had left and walked out to the wilderness. So the remains of the other three were found scattered in the forest over the following kind of couple of months, mainly reduced to bone by animals and weather. They had all died of exposure out in the open. But the body of Gary has never been found, not even a trace beyond his shoes in the trailer, which is very, very strange. So if you think about this case as a whole, we've got five men who really like routine, really like stability, who drive the wrong direction. And instead of trying to rectify the situation, venture off into further harm into the wilderness. Mm. But when they find help, they kind of choose to ignore it.
Something or maybe an idea was put in their minds.
Maybe
that there was something to be frightened of.
Or that's it, potentially, or that this was some sort of mission that they had to complete, or that maybe they felt they were further along than they were and they were in much greater. Now, there was a lot of snow, but also there would have been people trekking through these mountains around those times. That indicates that maybe they could have sought help if they wanted, especially if they'd found the trailer. I'm sure there was other means to communicate with people or No attempt seems to have been made to go back to the car either to try and seek out help.
Mm. But, and these trailers were there specifically, were they specifically for people if you got lost in the forest?
I think they were there and for forest rangers and things like that. They're belonging to the Forest Service. But again, that feels like something that maybe somebody should check in on every now and then.
Yeah.
If there's anybody in the trailers using the food, or are there any radios in them that people can make contact on?
And so I assume there were theories about what may have happened to them.
A lot of the theories were that these men were kind of slightly medicated, that they might have come disorientated or frightened or fixated on some type of fear, or kind of a collective fugue state, and had made decisions that really only made sense to them. But then in a group, the panic takes hold of them all together and they feel like they're in something much bigger than they actually are. It's very, very strange. There's also kind of the idea that because they were quite honest fellows, that they maybe came across all this food and felt that because it wasn't theirs, they wouldn't take it or steal it.
But they must have had some of it if he'd grown a beard. He must have eaten it.
Yeah, they must have. I mean, they were incredible. But the body suggested he was very malnourished. But he must have had something.
So strange. Anyway, the final story, I guess this is life imitating art, really, and in a very, very literal sense.
This is exactly it. This is incredible, and I can't believe it's not talked about more, but Agatha Christie herself decided to leave this out of her memoir. So this is an incredible tale that for 11 days, Agatha Christie, who was obviously one of the greatest crime writers of all time, disappeared and vanished. We're in December 1926 and she's 36 years old. She's not quite yet to the level of fame that we know her, but she's definitely on the rise. Her detective fiction, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, had just been published, and that particular twist was gaining a lot of notoriety. So she was famous and she was affluent, and she, you know, she had means. But in that, during that particular period of her life, she was dealing with incredible pain. Her mother had passed away and her husband, bad man, Archie, had fallen in love with a younger woman named Nancy Neal. And that very night, he had come home and asked Agatha for a divorce, saying that he was leaving her for the younger woman and he intended to spend the weekend with his friends and his mistress.
Okay.
Definitely a kick. So later that night, Agatha goes in and kisses her sleeping seven-year-old daughter, gets into her car, drives off into the dark. And the car is found the next morning, abandoned, its nose pointing towards a chalk pit near a place in Newlands Corner in Surrey. Inside are her fur coats, very glam, and a small case of belongings, but no Agatha. So anyone who finds it reads the scene like you would a detective novel, looking for the clues, thinking that maybe she had gotten in distress and left her car on the edge and then got into trouble, that her coat had been abandoned, all these kind of weird little clues. What follows is a large manhunt, one of the largest Britain has ever seen for a missing person because she's so famous. So over 1,000 police officers are involved. Aircrafts are used. Hundreds of volunteers comb through the countryside trying to find her. And the lake near where the car was found is actually dragged. So they're going everywhere. Newspapers obviously picking up on this. She's a famous novelist who's vanished in circumstances that look exactly like one of her own plots. Even fellow crime writers get involved. Sir Anthony Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes's, you know, creator, takes one of her gloves to a psychic medium to try and figure out where she's gone.
That'll work.
Yeah, I mean, but this is great. Great fodder for a story. And suspicion falls on the husband, which I think might be the intention here. So it writes itself. There's an unhappy marriage, an affair, and a wife who vanishes after a row. A car left to suggest that something untoward has happened. He comes under real scrutiny. All eyes on him. He's getting a lot of negative attention. I don't like him and I never met the guy. So for 11 days, the most likely explanation is that something dark has happened and he is responsible. So as you can well imagine, he's not a liked figure in the British public. And then she's found alive, entirely unharmed, 200 miles north in a spa, which I think is just absolutely how you should do it. She's been there the whole time. She's taken a train, checked into the Swan Hydropathic Hotel, spent 11 days being pampered. She's described as a perfectly pleasant and sociable guest. She joined in on the dancing and she sat there in the bar reading the newspapers about her own disappearance the entire time. She checked in under an interesting name, Mrs. Theresa Neal, obviously using the same surname as her husband's mistress, which I think is indicative of maybe her motivations for doing this and the attention she wanted to bring them. It's a bit Gone Girly, isn't it?
Yes,
except without locking yourself in a room. And when she was found, she tried again, leaning on this amnesia, sort of memory loss excuse that we see so often. She kind of thinks that maybe it's brought on by a minor car accident. or the immense strain. But some doctors have described that when you're under that amount of stress and under that amount of trauma, you know, the death of her mother and the reveal of this affair, it's likely that she went into a genuine fugue state, a real kind of dissociative condition in which she just sort of had to alleviate and had to remove herself from reality for a moment. But what actually happened, we'll never know because she refuses to talk about it.
Mm. Because the car is left beside a chalk pit.
Yeah.
So presumably that's miles away from anywhere. How did she get from there to the train station?
She walks, I think she walks and gets the train. Or she's Agatha Christie. She probably hitchhiked a little bit. So there's no shortage of anyone who'd give her a lift, I'd say.
But you think somebody would have come forward and said, Agatha Christie, I had that Agatha Christie in the back of my car.
But I mean,
car.
We're in the 1920s, so they don't have as much, they don't have as many visual representations. So people probably didn't recognise her immediately. But I could just imagine her sitting, drinking a sherry or a dry martini in the bar, giggling away, reading the paper reports as the nation goes to town on her cheating husband.
And she never explained.
Never explained it, left it out of her biography, said she never wanted to talk about it again, which I think is fair.
Yeah, fair enough. I wonder what happened to the husband and whether it lasted with Teresa or not after all that pressure. Mm. You'd think not. Cassie, thanks a million.
Thank you.
As ever, Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.